Welcome back to the Autoblog Podcast. I'm Greg Migliori. We've got a great show for you today. Got a special guest host joining me from Yahoo Finance is Pras Subramanian. How are you, man?
I'm good. Just enjoying the summer here as we roll along.
Sounds good. It's pretty hot here in Michigan. I know in the Northeast, you guys get it just as hot, if not more so. But good time to drive some cars, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's like the wonderful time that we have here now. So we actually have a bit more time to do it and better weather. So very exciting.
Exactly. So we got a great show for you. Let's dive right in. We're going to talk about the Kia EV6, the Nissan Frontier, Land Rover Range Rover, and the Volkswagen Taos, which is actually sitting in my driveway right now. So kind of a robust drive section. A lot of news this week. We're going to talk about the states of Bentley, Ferrari, and Polestar. We'll close things out with just what we're seeing in the sales trends. And of course, we're going to talk a little bit of Tesla. If you enjoy the show, that's podcast@autoblog.com. Send us your Spend My Monies, five-star rating on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. I think we're just about everywhere. So let's jump right in. Pras, you were in the EV6. I was in one about 3 weeks ago. I am very interested to hear what you think. This is, for me, one of the more interesting vehicles I've driven, electric or otherwise. I'll throw it over to you. What do you think?
Yeah, you know, Greg, it's, again, I've been having these situations where I've been, you know, here you're going to get this car, electric car. I've been sort of ambivalent. Okay, great, lukewarm. It's going to be boring. Kia EV6 pops up in this nice, like, matte gray finish. Actually, a pretty nice looking car from an exterior design point of view. I was surprised. It looks nice and very different than its twin, right? The Ioniq 5. So got picked up the car. Again, the interior also, lots of thought went into that to make it a bit different than its sibling and a bit more futuristic in a nice way. And I thought it drove great, even though I was in the kind of the single motor car with the 225 horsepower powertrain there with the single motor and then in that 77 kilowatt battery. I still thought it gave decent power, nice drive in the city. I was in the city mostly. I think it's a really capable car, Greg, and I think that it's very well designed and has a lot of features that I think people would need. It's got that combination of crossover versus kind of hatchback. So it has a nice size and great driving dynamics, and with everything pushed off to the wheels pushed out to the side and battery down low. Again, these EV cars are great, and you know, I was getting around 300 miles, 290 miles of range, so not too bad, not too shabby. And for the price, this one was around $53,000 before any tax breaks or credits. It's not a bad car at all.
It sounds like you and I maybe had the exact same car. As you know, there's a lot of interplay between the fleets, especially from the upper Midwest here to the East Coast. I thought it really made a statement with that kind of matte, like silvery gray finish with the big wheels. Kia, I give them a lot of credit. They go aggressive when it comes to many of their designs. And I kind of like the EV6 a little more than the Ioniq 5, which is, to your point, that's the mechanical twin, basically. I'm in the minority at Autoblog. Everybody else here likes the Ioniq 5. They think it's this like great, almost like 80s throwback thing. What do you think?
So I will say that I dig the Ioniq 5's exterior a lot. I think it's got that, you know, what like a GTI would look, a retro futuristic GTI or something like that. But I thought the interior of the Kia was way better. I like the touches that they had, and the Hyundai had a bit, it seemed a bit more, I don't know, not as fluid. It seemed a bit more kind of boxy, right? Interior wise, I thought. I thought the Kia was a bit more streamlined, a bit more comfortable, nice seats, I thought. I like that kind of like that vegan materials they're using, the kind of cloth they're using in that car. Did a really good job. I mean, I was impressed fit and finish wise. I think it's a great car. I'll have to do an actual drive in the Ioniq 5, but I'm with you in the sense that I kind of like the entire package of the Kia at this point more than I do the Ioniq 5.
Yeah, it's for me, it really comes down to like, I really like the emotion that the EV6, I think, can kind of bring to the table from the taillights, all the way to just, it's kind of got like a speed wagon profile, which I think is cool.
Exactly right. Especially with that sort of the wheels at the ends of the car. I also want to just note that it has that onboard power generator where you can actually power a bunch of things that a lot of cars in its class don't have, right? That V to L, I think that's what they call it. So it's kind of a nice feature there too.
Did you have to charge your EV6 when you were driving it?
You know, I didn't I had maybe about 200 miles ish of range or of seat time in that car. So I didn't need to do that. As you know, where I live in Manhattan, it's problematic finding chargers because you got to go to garages or go out of the city. And, you know, it's a big pain. So luckily I did not have to deal with that, but that is an issue with these cars, at least for people living in cities.
Yeah, I honestly didn't have to charge it either. It's kind of funny. It came fully charged. I drove it for about, I think I had 4 or 5 days, and it was still about maybe like a third. Swapped it out with one of our other editors, and I got something like a Ram or something. It was like totally like opposite ends of the spectrum. I forget what the car was. But charging is, I find it interesting, like the different approaches companies are taking with charging, whether it's like, hey, we're just going to kind of team up with Electrify America, whether you're, you know, your Tesla, and of course you want to do your own thing with the supercharger network. It's a big problem around here. Like I live in like the suburbs of like, you know, Detroit, north of Detroit. So it's actually not too hard to find a charger. Like there's a lot of like malls, libraries, even some of the cities do it, but it's also not the easiest thing. Like there's nowhere near as many chargers as there are gas stations. So to me, it's like a bigger problem than just like at the OEM level. It's like, I wonder if maybe like, you know, you look at some of the like political solutions, which obviously is always tricky. But I mean, honestly, if I were looking to try to do the next big thing, I wouldn't make another electric car. I would make the charging network for the electric cars. If I were like Jeff Bezos or somebody, that's what I would do.
Yeah. You know, we're going to have on the Volta chief commercial officer next week on Yahoo Finance, because they struck a deal with Kroger, right, to start installing their charging infrastructure, their units in Kroger's. And it seems like, you know, when we talk about how are we going to charge these cars and where, places like a grocery store, like a Kroger or even a Starbucks seem like the natural fits, right? Because you're going to go there and maybe hang out there for at least 10 to 20 minutes. You got a DC fast charger, maybe you got a decent amount of juice in the car. So that's like this equation we're talking about as we look at a society and we look at our towns and our places where we shop, where we go. Is that where we're going to add these chargers? And Greg, you're right. As from a business opportunity, if you can do this, deploy these things in a strategic way, cost effective way, it's a big opportunity there, right?
Yeah, I mean it's definitely, you know, to use the buzzword monetization. I mean this is an opportunity that's ripe for it, but there's obviously some startup costs too. I mean, we're looking to monetize things. So yeah, I mean, hey, that's, you know, that would be one way to do it. Get the word out.
Yeah,
Well, how about we shift gears over to the frontier? That is, it's been a while since I have driven one, but I generally liked it. This is like Nissan really let that old generation of the frontier run for forever. Then they rolled this out, made them immediately more competitive. Interestingly, there's still some of the like the underparts, the underpinnings of the old Frontier still live on with this thing. So I'm curious, what did you do with this? Did you go upstate? What did you do?
So, you know, kind of an interesting story here with this Frontier, because I'm a fan of these midsize pickups and they're the right size really, right? So at the New York Auto Show, I met with Nissan's head of design, Alfonso Albesa, and we're talking about their new electric car, which now the name escapes me.
the Ariya.
Yeah, the Ariya or whatever. Ariya, and other cars there.
And then I mentioned to him, I was like, hey, you know, Alfonso, you know, what about the new Frontier? He's like, that's my favorite car. He's like, I designed that to kind of give it a very Japanese look, the new one at least. It's a very Japanese, he said, almost an even anime kind of look, like it would, you'd see it in an anime, and with that kind of like very squared off front and almost like the homage to the hard body Nissan trucks of the past. And, you know, I was like, okay, so he was really excited about it. So I was like, you know what, I got to get in this car, in this truck. And I did. And Greg, I got to tell you, I was in the Pro 4X model, the all terrain, whatever you want to call it, off road model. I thought it looked great. You know, I love the design. inside the a welcome update to the interior, right, which is so dated now. It's kind of up to like where, you know, you're kind of like Tacoma style, right, at that level. You know, very nice, powerful engine. You know, it's funny, it drove, when I got in, drove it, it definitely is a truck, right? I don't know what you think, Greg, but it felt like a truck. You know, it was very like body on frame, like you turn the steering wheel, you get a turn a little bit later. But I thought the good power, 310 horsepower from that 3.8 liter V6, you know, good power, that 9-speed transmission, very smooth. You got the part-time four-wheel drive. I thought it was a great truck, and I think it's a great size. And we took it upstate. Wonderful up Hudson Valley, no problem at all. Little dirt roads here and there, it was handled, of course, no big deal. I think it's a really compelling package in that, you know, competing against the Colorado, the Tacoma, and others like that. So I like the Frontier a lot.
I agree with you. My son drove it, and he likes trucks because, you know, of course, little boys like trucks, right? And at first, I kind of wondered, would they keep that kind of truck dynamic here? And I think they fully captured that. I think it looks pretty good, too. It's kind of like a tough looking truck. It looks way better than the old one. Yeah, I think it's very credible in the segment. Would I say it's the best? I wouldn't. I think there's a lot of things in the midsize truck segment, which is, I think it's my favorite truck segment. If I were looking to get a truck, I would think, you know, one of those. I know we're going to see a new Ranger coming up, which will like update that truck, which is quite old. It's from, I think, Australia originally, which I'm really interested to see what they do there, because I actually like the current Ranger, old as it is. But I mean, long story short, I think the Frontier was not competitive before. It was like a value play. If you wanted a truck for like, what was it, like 18,000, 20,000 bucks, you could get it. If you wanted a truck from 2008 or whatever it was.
Yeah.
But now, you know, it's right in there. You know, it's in the mix, I think, with like, you know, like, it's tough to rank them. Let me throw a surprise curveball at you. What would you say is the best midsize truck right now?
You know, I was a fan of when the new Colorado came out. I liked that truck a lot. I thought it drove really smooth and had the right package, and that tried and true V6 was fine. The new Ranger, or I should say the Ranger that came out recently here, you know, I liked it, but I thought it was kind of plasticky. And I think it, like you said, the design was a little old, and nice power, right, from that turbo engine. But I just didn't like totally capture me. I know the Tacoma is just like your benchmark straight away, like kind of has everything you need. I'm not impressed by the power, though. It's really kind of, you know, it takes a while to get going. I think right now, I would have to say the Colorado and the Frontier are my favorites right now in that segment. I'm really looking for the new Ranger, because we saw the Amarok, the new VW Amarok, which is based on that thing, looks hot, right? So
it does.
If it's going to keep better interiors, comfort and features, better power, you know, I think that could be a really big, the Ford Ranger could be the top of the line there. But as of right now, the Frontier and Colorado, I think, are my favorites.
Colorado is, I think, really good at everything. I think it's maybe not like the most emotional truck in the segment, but it's very trucky, but it's also pretty drivable. You could get like kind of a pretty intense, like off-road version with a ZR2.
Yes.
Big fan of the Colorado. I think almost illogically, I still like the Ranger a lot, but metrically, like to your point, if you like, we actually have an Autoblog score sheet where we grade different parts of the vehicles. You know, a few years ago, we said it was best in class. I wouldn't say that now. You know, it's just the interior. So many different things have passed it by. And the Gladiator, of course. I think that's a great, the Jeep truck is just kind of expensive.
Yeah. You could even say the Maverick. I mean, would you prefer a Maverick over the Ranger? It's because it's just so, it seems so composed. I will say we're going to get a lot of hate from Tacoma people, right?
I like the Tacoma. It's fun to drive, but I mean, I'm not even that tall, but it's pretty cramped in there. You know, the infotainment looks like it's from, you know, I don't know, the era the Wallflowers would be playing on it. It's a dated truck, I would say.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I know it's super capable, but it just seems so sluggish to me. And at this day and age, we don't need to have sluggish trucks. Like there's more there for you. And even you don't have to suffer from any kind of MPG problem either. So Yeah, this is it's an exciting segment, Greg. I totally agree. And you have stuff like the Hyundai Santa Fe's of the world too, right? So
yeah,
Santa Cruz of the world. That's a whole other thing that's popping up too.
Yeah, no, it's interesting. You know, you can get like Maverick and Santa Cruz step up to all of these other trucks we just, you know, named, and then obviously go full size. And you know, it's interesting, you know, you guys probably saw this, the Nissan Titan is reportedly on its way out.
Yes.
So there is like a Darwinism to this segment. You know, if you can't cut it, you're done.
Which seems kind of crazy, right? Like you're going to kill the full size or pseudo full size truck, that Titan that it seems like you need to have in America to compete, but seemingly people aren't buying it. I mean, you're just going Tundra, you're going F-150, you're going Silverado. I mean, and Ram, of course. Like, is that it? Is there's no more room for the Titan?
I thought it was a nice Apparently package.
Not. You know, I thought it was a decent truck. I would probably put it right in there with the Tundra as far as like, you know, ranking them behind all of the Detroit trucks. And I would include the Sierra in there. The Sierra is a pretty good truck. Sometimes we tend to like, you know, just mismatch it with the Silverado, but I would put all of them ahead of them. And the Tundra, the new Tundra. Pretty credible. So yeah, I guess honestly, you got to drop it behind the new Tundra.
We'll get a new Tacoma too.
I mean, at that point, what are you even doing? You know, like you've got trucks of different sizes and shapes kind of coming at you. You're really caught in like a pincer movement. And yeah. I mean, from a business standpoint, I could totally see like just draw the line and say, hey, we're only selling this many. It's making this much money. We got to spend that money somewhere else. So I get it.
Now you're seeing more of the mainstreaming of it. And I just want to throw an anecdotally. My brother has two young kids and his wife, and they have two cars that they use. And they're like, they want to get a pickup. Okay. They want to get a pickup that they can just throw stuff in the back and have fun. And that's want to be their third car. So there you go. That's your third car, right? It's a fun little pickup. So I think that's what we're seeing more of that emerging in this country of people wanting that fun activity vehicle.
I'm going to kind of live that life next week, I think. We're going to try to like maybe go over to Chicago for a little bit. Mm-hmm. And the vehicle that I'm looking to take is a Ram. And I think it's actually a Ram Rebel, which is going to be amazing for like 95% of the drive because it's big. It's comfortable, right? You know, fly out on 94. Parking in Chicago with a Ram Rebel is going to be, I don't know, I might just valet it and be like, here you go, man. Like, put it in the hotel. If you scratch it, I know where to send the bill. But I can see that truck kind of like, it's just a fun vibe. You know, you load everybody up in the pickup and away you go. So
kids love the trucks, man.
They do.
They just think it's a massive toy. And like, we're like, yeah, it is. It is a massive toy. We love it. You know,
kids. I mean, it's funny. And Jeeps too. That's the other one that like my son is obsessed with, the Jeep Wrangler and the Ford Bronco a little bit too. So.
Dude, kids, we're talking about, we're adults, we're still, I'm still, you know, into these trucks, so.
This is one of the, 100%. I mean, you get to write about cars. What could be better than that in many ways? So, Land Rover, Range Rover. Pretty cool, luxurious SUV to drive. It's actually been a little while since I've been in the Rover. I'm going to get in this one, I think, towards the end of the month. So, I mean, I guess you tell me, I mean, what did you think of it?
So I just got out of it actually over the weekend. And so it's pretty fresh in my mind. And a few things just off the top of my head. I mean, the design of it is got this futuristic vibe, right? Like hardcore, you know, recent Range Rovers have kind of been edging more towards a design philosophy of very clean, not so much rugged looking, the old school LWBs of days gone by, counties of the past. Now, again, it's very, very futuristic vibe, especially now with the new Range Rover, because it's going to be that all electric at some point, I think in 2024. So you have this really modern look, ultra luxurious inside, right? This is the first edition model. It's got leather headlining, it's got leather everywhere. I got to say the drive, this was a pre-production build, but it felt very, very production. The drive was like a magic carpet ride, right? That almost like the Rolls Royce sort of floating on those air suspension, absorbing all the city ruts and cracks and potholes. It was just so smooth, composed. Yeah, it's a bit wallowy if you're trying to drive it slightly aggressively, but it's just so comfortable as a daily driver. My God, I can't imagine. You just get that thing, you just sink into it, right? The seats are so comfortable. I have 520 horsepower around that, so that's, you're not lacking for any power there for a car that's, you know, weighing you know, what, 5,000-6,000 pounds. So I was very impressed. This is a very expensive car. We're talking about a car that operates in the, you know, Mercedes SUV, the top of the line.
The GLS, I guess.
Yeah, the G wagon's another thing, but yeah, it's in that same level of price. But it's ultra luxurious. You can get chauffeured in this thing. It's an amazing animal. But we're talking about also the future of Land Rover. It's, you know, they're hinting at this is where it's going to be, or we're going to go EV at some point. I mean, though our customers love the cars as is, they're going to offer that car in an EV next. It has the looks of that.
Interesting. Okay, where do you, when you look at Land Rover, how do you think they're sitting right now in that kind of luxury marketplace? And this is kind of like, I guess, a preview for where we're going to go next here. Mm-hmm. But I mean, you think they're in a position of strength? I mean, generally when I drive their products, I find them to be interesting. They're always different, you know, more interesting than if you wanted to get like, yeah, I think the Germans tend to have like, they have their mold, you know, like if you want to get a very expensive like Ford Expedition or something, you could argue that's luxurious. I think they have like an identity, but I mean, it's tough out there, you know? I mean, what do you think?
I think that they are in a, I would say a good and bad position where they're extremely popular, right? People buy or want the Defenders. They want the new Range Rover Sport. Their Range Rover fans are there and they're not going to go away. From what they were telling me, people at the company, and this is like no open secret, it's the fact that yes, we have to go EV because that's where the market wants us to go. That's where the future is. But our customers say, don't change anything. They're literally telling them, don't change anything. We like how things are. So they have this sort of customer base that's very old school. They're upper crust, they got money, but they don't necessarily want to maybe go fully EV right away. So they're trying to thread that needle where they're going to say, okay, we're going to offer these cars in both standard powertrains, but also we're going to start going EV with the Range Rover, Range Rover Sport, right? Those are the 2 miles that they're going to go EV by 2024. And then they want to have something like 6 EV miles by 2026 and then be sort of like 60% EV by 2030. So their sort of goals are not as aggressive as the rest of the industry. So, but I could see why, you know, they're trying to go to the future, but also they're trying not to piss off their very, very particular clients.
Yeah, no, it's interesting. And of course they're owned by Tata, and that's like a pretty big like industrial conglomerate. So there is money there if they need to pivot. They have sort of like a sibling brand with Jaguar. So it's interesting.
I'd ask you that, Greg. I mean, I'm curious about what you think about Jaguar, because to me it seems like a brand that's sort of floating around and doesn't sort of have a vision yet as to what it wants to be. You know, I was just in the UK I was at Goodwood, and it's funny, you see a lot of Jags on the road because they, you know, it's a British mark that they like. Like you don't see any Jaguars around here, right? I mean, it's so rare other than SUVs.
You know, it's interesting. We see a few of them. You might see more Jaguars around Michigan than you might expect. You do see a lot of the F-Pace, which is probably the one you see the most of. I actually feel like Land Rover is in a better spot because, you know, like we covered, they do have an identity.
For sure.
And the Defender, I think, is really, really a nice vehicle. That's one of the more interesting ones that I've seen in a few years. It was nice. They took almost like a little more of a subtle take on that rough and tough off-roading segment. But with Jaguar, it's like, you know, I know they're talking electrification, but to me, Jaguar is a sports car brand. And the F-Pace is like, I believe their best seller, right up there with the E-Pace. The E-Pace to me is invisible in that segment. You know, it's smaller. It has less of an identity. It's not really any of the things that Jaguar needs to be. So I personally think they need to get back to having like another car in there that's like at or near the best of class. It can be electric. I don't care. Style it up, make it beautiful. And that's what Jaguar is. I mean, not many people buy Jaguars for the engines, to be honest. You know, usually the stereotype is like, well, it's a Jaguar. You got to have another one for when it doesn't start. I think they've since put that mostly behind them. But I mean, it's only been fairly recently that Jaguar has really gotten into this almost like hot rodding. You know, I drove an S-Pace SVR with a 5-liter V8, which is just amazing. I left a hole in the ozone layer behind me. But
how great does that car sound?
Oh my gosh.
I loved it. I loved it.
Cold start. I mean, what's better than that? Wake up the whole neighborhood. So
And people said it's the best sounding car out there right now. I'm like, it's it might
there,
be.
Yeah. It's up there. Yeah. Yeah. I had a Maserati Levante, I think it was the Trofeo, which had another big big V8 that just Ferrari. Sounded awesome. Yeah, yeah. Ferrari V8.
Yeah.
So, yeah, we'll see when it comes to Jaguar, I guess. But yeah, we'll close things out real quickly. I'm in the Volkswagen Taos right now. Small crossover. Mine has the 4Motion all-wheel drive. Handles really well. It's got that pretty nice interior. I like the steering, if you will. Plenty of room for like just like a small family. You know, very, you know, it's very, you know, usable. Powertrain's a little weird. I've noticed that in Volkswagens lately, just with like the engine and the transmission. It seems like, I don't know, it's a little bit of a like a delay at times, which bugs me. I've sort of solved that by driving in sport mode all the time, which kind of keeps the shifts a little quicker. Really nice looking thing. It's bright red. So it's, yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's a small crossover. It's sort of unremarkable, but I'd say it's competitive.
You have two kids. Yeah.
Just the one. So this is probably perfect for him, but not for two is how I would put it.
That's what I was going to ask. Like, you think it'd be too tight for two kids? And is it a DCT? Like what's the deal with that? Is it kind of like, is that why it's sort of hunting around or?
Yeah, it is the, let me pull up the specs real quick and I can give you the full deep dive here, but it's one of those things too, where I almost feel like they kind of like went off the shelf with like everything here, so to speak. So it's just very like Volkswagen-y in every sense. And it's like right kind of in the, I would say like the middle of the segment, if you will. Here's why I think this is what bugs me the most is it's a 1.5 liter. That's what I was looking for, four cylinder. Mm-hmm. So respectable and it's fine, but it's a 7-speed DCT. That's what I was looking for. Mm-hmm. I was thinking it was a 9-speed for some reason, but no, it's a 7-speed. And it just, those two don't seem to play nicely, in my opinion. You know, I think I like a dual clutch is great. You know, that's fine. In many applications, in fact, but I don't know. I think it might just be, it's like, it's the small displacement engine with, you know, the dual clutches trying to fight it out. It's not great. You know, it's 1.5 liters.
1.5 liters.
Yeah. I mean, that's probably the overarching problem.
It
makes a big difference, right? As we still kind of linger with these, with the gas powered engines, you know, it's to get smaller and more efficient, but they also like kind of like, let's move, let's go.
Yeah.
At some points.
It's funny. I was actually changing lanes in the Taos, and sometimes I'm like, I was listening to sports talk. I wasn't exactly in my like, you know, lime rock mode of driving. Let's put it that way. Mm-hmm. Get over, nail the gas, and this guy in like a Honda, I think it was an Accord, was just bearing down on me. I'm like, yeah, it's fine. You know, you got room here. And I'm all of a sudden I'm sitting there like, okay, come on, dual clutches. Let's get this thing in gear. We got to go. You know, this guy's coming at you. So, you know, I didn't think I was in a McLaren, but this thing's a little, I don't know. I will say this. It looks pretty good. I think Volkswagen design in recent years it's a nice look. You know, I think they've done a good job of creating this kind of like, it's like very like, blocky isn't the right word, chiseled, to use that cliche, but like if you don't want to spend the money on an Audi, like it's there for you.
I was just thinking, it's like, you know, it's Audi is the big brother, right? Because the design language is like, they're more about the hard edges, not so much the curves. And I kind of think that's a nice look as we kind of progress into the mid 2020s here, and they move on. VW, Jesus, I mean, how much are they investing in their future? So the Taos and also the Tiguan. I have a friend that has a Tiguan. He says he'll never buy another car ever again. He just wants to keep buying Tiguans
over and over again. The guy's just like, it's comfortable. Okay. It's been A to B. You know, it's good. You know, okay, fine. You don't care.
Volkswagen buyers, I think, they can be very loyal. So it's funny. I have a friend too who has a Jetta, and it's like the newer Jetta that's a little more sedan as opposed to the hatchback from like I think of like college and high school for people driving Jettas, but he's like in no hurry to get rid of it. I'm like, hey man, like you can get something a little better here. You know, he has two kids and, you know, we'll meet up for golfing. And I'm like, there's two car seats in there. I'm like, you know, but so to your point, though, people are like, they're loyal to Volkswagen, especially if the cars keep running and the reliability is like, okay. You know, I mean, yeah. The whole diesel thing maybe had some issues with their quality and just in general image and environmental friendliness. But
that just reminds me of one quick thing, Greg, that I wanted to say about the Range Rover. I took it to a Cars and Coffee
I
was at this over the weekend. A couple of Range Rover fans came up and they said, is that the new one? They were all excited. The one thing they've all said to me was guys were like, yeah, I used to own a Range Rover.
And I sold it right before the warranty ran out. Like they knew like, I don't want this thing. So that's a problem, right? That's
good
a
problem. Move.
Yeah, they were afraid, deathly afraid of that.
Yeah, no, that's a good move. Well, should we talk some news?
Yeah, sure.
All right, let's jump in. You did a piece recently on Bentley and just what's kind of going on with them. We've got three different brands here in the news segment. Rather than just kind of like run through different like little nuggets of news, we've both, Autoblog's been covering some of these things. Polestar just did an IPO. Ferrari's made some news about mainly being like they're still going to offer you some, you know, ICE options under the hood for a while. And of course, the Purosangue is coming up too. We could probably riff on that. But let's start off with Bentley. When you look at their lineup and just in some of your reporting, you know, where are you thinking they stand? Just real quick in that kind of state of the union for Bentley.
You know, they've been really hitting their mark in the last few years with great design, the kind of vehicles that people want with the Continental GT and even the Flying Spur at that level of where you want to be chauffeured and stuff like that and places like in Bentayga, right? So doing well in North America, Europe, and also Asia, which is pretty big for them, China with the Bentayga and the Flying Spur. You know, I spoke to them, went to the factory actually, Greg, I went to Crewe of all places.
Nice. And,
they have a great facility there. They're 3,000 factory workers making these cars, about 100 a day-ish they're making there, which is pretty nice. And I saw the Mulliner division too. And the big news is Mulliner, known as like their coach building, their custom shop. They want to basically make Mulliner like a sub brand of Bentley, where all the highest end cars, like think like the M cars or like the AMG cars, will be the Mulliner Bentley cars. So they're sort of, you know, differentiating the brand in new ways and thinking about expanding the brand. And of course, they're going to go all electric, right? That's their goal. And I think it works well for them. You're talking about performance and comfort and, you know, quiet. You know, a very, very kind of quiet ride. And so for the Rolls Royces and Bentleys of the world, maybe electrification works because it's sort of like where you want to be as a ultra premier brand. So I think they're in a good spot, the driver's seat, great place for them right now. You know, with VW ownership, they're going to have the money to invest and people are, I think they told me people are excited about an EV future too.
Yeah, no, I think that's true. I drove we talked about this a couple shows ago. I drove the Rolls-Royce Cullinan recently, and I tended to think, talking about Magic Carpet Ride, that's another brand that I like Bentley. I feel pretty like optimistic about their future, and they live in these places where like the business case, as long as you like sort of have it and you have the identity and the vision, you know, you just kind of got to plug in different things. Like, okay, we're going to go EV now. We're going to do this. We're going to do an SUV finally for both of them. But yeah, I mean, it's just a side note. The Cullinan was pretty awesome. That was, have you ever driven a Rolls Royce? You probably have.
I have. Yeah. I've driven the Cullinan too. And just, you know, I've taken people in it, you know, and they're like, what's the big deal? It's Rolls Royce. So why is so much money? And if you ride in it and you're like, oh my God, okay,
yeah.
I understand. I can't hear anything. It's completely cocooned. You're floating everywhere. This is how motoring is. You can't believe it. And if you drive it, then you're like, well, this car is actually fun to drive. I mean, it's just so laid back.
Totally shocked by that, but exactly.
And did some of the Black Badge cars that are the ones that are a bit more heightened. And they do the right mix of, we'll give you a little bit of performance, but it still rolls, right? And you can drive, right? Greg, you can drive the car 8 hours and not feel fatigued at all, right? Like, you just get out, you're like, oh, no big deal. No, you're paying for it, but it's just such a world of motoring that only they kind of occupy, right? It's just unbelievable, to me at least.
I was honestly like, you are totally correct. I couldn't believe how easy, I guess, to say it was to drive. Like, you could see out of it. The steering is like, like basically kind of light. So it wasn't like intimidating. And this is something that is like, it's like basically Chevy Tahoe sized, and the Tahoe is a little bit of work to drive. You know, I think it's actually bigger on, I forget if it's 4 inches wider, I want to say. So it's a big vehicle, the Cullen is. So, yeah, I don't know. This is hilarious. I almost am looking forward to driving the, you know, a different Rolls to see, you know, if it has that same dynamic.
Yeah, the Cullen has that sort of, you know, the split back where you can set up the seats and watch the polo match or whatever people do with those cars. So it's all lifestyle.
Did yours have the whiskey decanters?
it did not, unfortunately. But I heard you got that. You can get the champagne thing in the middle, in the back, right? I love the fact you can push the button to close the door, though. That's still super cool. After that, I never once pulled the door. I just pushed the button.
Oh, 100%. Yeah, my kid learned how to do that. He was just like, "No, I got it, Dad. It's the button." Okay, cool. We had a Maybach, S-Class Maybach a while back, and that has silver-plated flutes in the back, too. So if you're at a certain income level, you can really get some nice drinking ware in your cars. The problem is the flutes they took them out because of COVID, like just a couple years ago. They were like, we decided there's like some liability and like, you know, sharing cups literally with like world-traveling automotive journalists. Plus, like it's like silver. You can't just throw it in the dishwasher. So those are a little tough. I remember a few years ago, we had one of these, and like 8. And I got in the back of one. I opened up like a LaCroix and started drinking it. And I remember this is like 2014. Our video guy was like, "Sure you want to drink out of that? Like, you know who drove this thing last?" And so a totally different world on so many levels. Anyways, let's talk Ferrari. I don't know if they come with flutes. They probably do if you ask them and you're rich enough, right? But just some news there. I mean, they're going to stick with some ICE options under the hood for a while. And we also know the Purosangue is coming very soon, which is sort of their version of I'd say it's more of a crossover than an SUV. But I think they're in a solid spot too. So, you know, what do you think?
Yeah, you know, they had their capital markets day earlier in June, and they talked about sort of like they want to aim for 80% battery EV sales by 2030. And they had some very loose sort of guidelines about, you know, we're going to release a electric car, I think, in 2025, right? They're going to show it to you guys. But they're really dragging their feet in terms of, you know, they know, if anyone knows their customers, they know what their customers want. They want those stonking engines that, you know, I think Benedetto, the CEO, Benedetto Vigna, the CEO, talked about how, like, some guy, I'm gonna butcher this, but he told us about how he delivered a car to one of their owners, and the guy literally cried after hearing the engine. So it's like, you know, these people are so passionate about these cars, and I think they're just freaked out about, if we go all electric, it's like we're gonna miss that sound, that emotional part of our ownership experience. That being said, they got to go electric. They've already been doing that with hybrid supercars, right? They've already adding hybrid technology, so they'll probably do that for a long time, and maybe throw a bone to the EV people and, hey, here's your EV whatever. Maybe it'll be like a grand touring car. I have no idea. But the Purosangue, I mean, that's been, you tell me, Greg, I feel like why is it taking so long? Like, they're just losing out to their competitors at this point, right?
Yeah, it's interesting because I think it's like anything, you know, where there's like people have different priorities. I sort of feel like it's not a huge priority for Ferrari. I feel like they, you know, exactly. Look at all, since we first like saw it, if you will, or like learned of it, how many things have they rolled out like in the interim?
So, I can't even keep track of all the cars they have.
Yeah. Out. And that's good for them, right? You know, you're Ferrari, like we talked about Jaguar a few minutes ago. Where are the cars with them? With Ferrari, they're like, yeah, we're working on the SUV. Don't worry. Here's the latest version of our, you know, mid-engine sports car, which I'm actually kind of okay with. I'm not necessarily sure from an enthusiast standpoint the world needs a Ferrari SUV. I do think the Ferrari customer needs an SUV, though. I think they are leaving money on the table. They're leaving some chips on the side. I think they got to get there. Yeah, I mean,
the Chinese market, the West yes. Coast. I mean,
I bet Europe probably doesn't give a shit. I'm sorry, give... give a hoot about that, but America and China, we talk about that endlessly. Like,
they are missing out there, right? And they're a public company.
Well, if you look at like the Macan and the Cayenne, I would argue if Porsche could do an SUV, and they were among the first too, Ferrari could do one. I mean, like Rolls Royce is doing an SUV, you know, and arguably they have more of a business case with like the people riding in their cars, and Ferrari probably doesn't. That's like the last thing people want to be thinking. But I mean, they're like, I kind of wonder too, if they're a company that's a little hamstrung by their history. You know, I, a few years back, I went to Maranello and toured the factory, you know, Luca di Montezemolo was
amazing.
Di Montezemolo was still in charge at that point. And the guy who you talk about these like iconic CEOs. I mean, he was a guy that was rumored to maybe run for prime minister of Italy. He was like, he was literally, I think, Italian royalty. So like, you know, then Marchionne took over. I'm not sure Di Montezemolo left voluntarily, so to speak. And now they've definitely, you know, they're, I don't know. I feel like, again, maybe their history is sort of slowing them down. Maybe they, there's a reticence there. And it does take time to develop cars. I'm sure they've got to make this one. This one has to be perfect. They can sort of miss on a sports car, and we're all going to still think it's pretty good. If they miss a, they miss on their SUV, well, that's going to be kind of a, you know, fried egg across the forehead, right? Like, you know, you can't miss on this.
Yeah, you know, just a couple points I want to make about the, so the SUV, you know, I was going to say, you know, look at Aston Martin with the DBX, right? That's, I think that's a, very, one of the most sportiest, if not the most sporty SUV I've ever driven in my life, right? In terms of like, it drives like a car. It has the utility that you need. It looks and I think feels great as a car. So, you know, there's the opportunity to sort of go in that direction and be like, this is the Ferrari of SUVs. You're going to know what, where you're in. This thing is amazing. But so the new CEO of Vigna, he's from a chip company, a computer chip company, right? So they're hinting like, when they hired him, this is where we're going to go, is the technology is our future. And that means, maybe means more, we are going to go with the EV at some point, but you know, that's part of what they, where they see, they're not like talking about like, it's being in a car guy. They brought in a chip guy, you know, like they're really leaning in on like the electronic part of it. And so they kind of see the future of the brand is high tech. Maybe he'll take them there kicking and screaming, but I don't know. I think it's sort of, we're sort of going to see where they're going to go by just who they have in charge.
Yeah, I think that's interesting. And it's worked with like Alan Mulally at Ford. You know, he was an airplane guy who came in. He was great setting a vision. He was a good CEO. You know, you don't have to be an expert to be a good CEO. In fact, sometimes it helps if you're not. Ferrari has all the money in the world. I honestly, like, I don't know if they need to go with like a chip guy to be their CEO, you know, they could go buy whatever they need to get their cars where they need to be. Like, you know, I don't know. Plus they have the whole Formula One thing where they're like making and spending gobs of money over there. The team's finally competitive this year for the first time in like years, basically. So, you know, we'll see. In some ways, I think I could see the F1 team maybe like wagging the tail of the dog a little bit there too. You know, because, and hey, it's F1, not like there's no politics there, right? So
I think you're absolutely right. This is the one car company in the world that's so tied to its racing team, that's so strongly tied to it, and the performance of the team, that the DNA is so race oriented that it's almost like, that's why we're having these issues with, why are they not, where's the SUV, where's the EV game plan, right? It's because, hey, we still race cars, and that's where we want to be, and that's where our clients want us to be.
Yeah, no, I mean, and I think it's great to have that kind of like those traditions, you know, it's almost like, you know, I like football. I've been to like Notre Dame Stadium. Like when you walk in there, it's like, that's a historic place for football, you know, and that's kind of how they are. But then in this new era of like, you know, you can pay your athletes in college football and like the conferences are doing all these things, not to go too sportsy here, but it's like the times are changing. And sometimes, you know, you wonder like if that prancing horse is going to like go in a new direction.
So yeah, I wanted to ask you about this. So I was in the Bentley factory and I kind of felt that history, and they took me I got a ride in one of these 1929 like race car, and Bentley race cars, right? With the open top, and I'm sitting next to the driver where like our shoulders are butting against each other, and you really felt, like, growing the English countryside, really felt that like this is what the company's about. Did you sort of feel that history the moment you walked through the gates and heard maybe the church bells? I'm just kidding.
But like, you know, in Maranello?
Definitely. It was, it was very historic. And I mean, even to the point of, it reminded me a little bit of like some of the things around Detroit where they've been making cars for like 100 years. Like, historic is a nice way to put it. Old is another way to put it too. You know, like, they look like a place that's been making cars since, you know, a really long time ago. So, yeah. So that's history. Company that has very little history, Polestar, they did their IPO this week. They are on the cutting edge with like their Android Auto infotainment system. It's all electric except for the Polestar 1, which was randomly a hybrid and super expensive and super limited edition. But the two, all these other ones we've been hearing, that's what's coming up next. I'm really intrigued by this company. I drove the two and thought it was a really credible kind of sports sedan, really an interesting alternative to Tesla. So,
yeah, you know, a very intriguing company with regards to ownership, right? Geely, yeah, and Volvo co-ownership. They just went public a couple of weeks ago. They closed their SPAC merger on the, so they're trading on the NASDAQ now. So they're a public company. Stock's not doing too well. It's doing okay. But I got to tell you that the portfolio of cars they have going on, really compelling stuff. The P1, I drove that too a year or two ago, and I thought that car was, that hybrid, I thought it was amazing. Design-wise, it's amazing.
Oh, yeah.
P2, a great, $56,000 car, like in that range. You know, like a mix of like a crossover with a sedan, does a great job, gives you all that you need. And then we're seeing, you know, the P5 and the P3, the other cars that are coming out, that Grand Touring, I saw that at Goodwood too. Beautiful. I mean, if that car comes out anything looking like what they had there going up the hill, that's a really compelling sedan type, you know, looking sporty car with that full EV powertrain. And got to be excited for the company that are putting those kinds of cars out like that, you know, when the EV sort of evolution is still on the way and they're really kind of there from the higher end point. So it's exciting stuff, and it's an interesting company with a great, as they call, asset light model, where they're able to use Geely and Volvo to help them build these cars.
Yeah, no, it's interesting the way they have grown. And Polestar, you know, is of course like a motorsports, essentially, like heritage background. They've really evolved it. I think it's been, I was very skeptical about like sort of this like kind of spin-off, make them their own brand, but I think they're kind of doing it. You know, I think their portfolio is going to be ambitious. Been impressed with the two models that I've been able to drive. I actually did a column on the Polestar 1 just saying, hey, this is actually the way to start. You know, the powertrain did not line up with like their stated mission, but that's okay because it was gorgeous. It was limited edition. And you put yourself on this plane of luxury. Whereas if they came out with the two first, well, okay, you're like a small sedan company that nobody even knows what it is. So
is it a Volvo? I mean,
exactly. Yeah. Cautiously optimistic on that front. And, you know, they have little, to me, they could almost be like an electric Volkswagen, you know, a little quirky. They could be like, they're maybe a little sportier than like a Volkswagen. They're a little more expensive, but like not too expensive. So impressed with the product, and you know, we'll see where they go next, I guess.
Yeah, I just got to say, you're absolutely right. I think they've really gone hard into like their design aesthetic, and we are this Nordic company.
Yeah,
very clean lines, very clean. Even the website is very clean, and the design is very flat, and it's got that vibe of like, we are just the future, right? The other thing is that I want to mention is like, so they have this state of the art factory in China, and people talk about like, oh, you don't want something in China. It's like, the Chinese factories are, they are incredible. They are state of the art, and they're building these cars cheaply. And if you look at the car, it looks like it was, you know, made in Germany. I mean, it just looks insanely just perfect, right? So they have a lot going on for themselves, and I think they've sort of, they're in the right sweet spot right now for that premium luxury brand that's going to be kind of like setting themselves up for the next century, right? In terms of where we are from electrification.
Yeah, and I think they're smart to focus on like, you know, the market in China and the market in the US, and you know, obviously probably Scandinavia a little bit too, and because you got to, right, if you're Polestar. But like, I mean, that's the way to like make a company like be a success, is take the obvious things in front of you and dial in there. Don't try to sell cars like everywhere and like try to like creep into markets where like Mercedes, Tesla, GM have been dominating for years. Like, don't do that. Just find your niches and go for it. And, you know, we'll see. I mean, I think they seem to have a pretty good plan and they seem to be getting investment. And, you know, I've been hearing honestly more about them than Volvo's lately, as far as just like from a news perspective. Like, when's the last time we heard anything out of Volvo?
I mean, 100%. And even in, from my point of view, in the Yahoo Finance area, that Polestar stock is one of the most highly tracked tickers on the site. So there's a lot of enthusiasm, not just the car people, but also the investment community, kind of excited about another pure play EV company that's out there. So for sure.
Sounds good. Talk some Q2 sales and just sales trends in general here. I think we're still seeing the effects of the chip shortage and some supply chain constraints and, you know, a little bit of shuffling of the pecking order. As far as like domestically, General Motors took off Toyota, which Toyota had picked them off for the first time in like ever, basically. So, but at the end of the day, a lot of these sales figures are just kind of like, it's like baseball. It's a long season, right? You know, you win in May, you got to keep winning. So I think in some ways you're seeing that, especially among the domestics, not worrying as much about who's number one in May or June, because, you know, whether you sold 280,000 cars or 270,000, doesn't matter as much as if you're profitable and if you can get people the cars that they want. Just given the way prices and inflation currently are just buffeting consumers, it's kind of a weird time to buy a car, I guess, to kind of bring it all together.
Yeah. You know, if you can, right. And it seems like the inventory situation is getting better, but there's a couple of high level notes that's been following over here. So, you know, we had GM come in, they've actually warned about their current second quarter profit. They took a little dip there because of the fact that, like you said, chip stuff, component shortages. They have something like close to 100,000 vehicles sitting at the factory that they can't deliver yet because of these shortages. So they're waiting to deliver those. So that's sort of weighing on them. But they reiterated their full year guidance. They said, we're still going to make a ton of money. We're okay. Second half of the year is going to look better than the first half. Then you have Ford, right? They actually sold more cars than they did last year this time, which is an improvement over the other large automakers. They actually did better this quarter than they did last year at the same time. So they're looking good. Their EV cars are selling like hotcakes, right? Huge percentage, double digit percentage gains and across those EV cars. Plus the Lightning was on sale. They sold like 1,800 Ford Lightnings last quarter. So that's going on. And that's going on, but good for them. On the flip side, Tesla, not necessarily the best Q2 in terms of production. They had a lot of problems in China with the COVID shutdowns, and that hurt them pretty badly, but they still delivered 250,000 plus cars, met their estimates, and they had the best June ever, they said, in terms of production. They had the best June ever, China really ramping up. Once we see Austin and Berlin really kind of there, if the demand is still there, which it seems like it is, they're going to be kind of also firing all cylinders come Q3, Q4.
And, you know, you mentioned earlier, we've talked about Tesla as kind of like a thread throughout the show. Interesting performance for them in China here in the second quarter.
Yeah, they had according to the Chinese Passenger Car Association, this government entity, Tesla had the best June or best month ever in June, delivered nearly 80,000 EVs, which is an astounding amount. If you think about over the course of a year, if they maintain that level, we're talking about like what, a million cars? I mean, something insane like that. But the one thing that they're going to do is in July, they're going to have to retool some of the factories. They're going to make some even more improvements. So they're going to shut down Model 3 and Model Y production for a few weeks in July. You know, it happens all the time, right, Greg? In every factory, they do that kind of optimization, retooling. So they're sort of setting themselves up for the back half of the year. But yeah, strong month in China. Really, they just, you know, Chinese, it's like, you know, in China, you can just multiple shifts keep going. Like, they're just pumping them out like crazy.
Sounds good. It's funny you mentioned that the way the sales are reported in China. When I covered the Shanghai Motor Show a few years back, and I literally had that like bookmarked, that all those numbers, just because you know you want it before you go to cover the show. You want to see like, well, who's selling what here, and it's a different way of reporting than anywhere else. But that also makes sense. You know, I mean, that's kind of how it is, and we had to get visas. It was a very complicated process. I remember I actually sailed through customs because I put writer on my thing. That's what I wrote at the time, or editor or something. Mm-hmm. Nobody said it otherwise. but the other guys in my traveling party, some other journalists put journalist, and I didn't think so. I usually put journalist on everything. I just didn't think of it. Maybe I had a few Heinekens on the flight over, and they were like, they had all kinds of issues. Finally, I think the PR guy had to tell them, he's like, look guys, for you to enter the country, you're going to have to say you work at Home Depot or something. And like, it literally, they were like, yeah, we know you're coming to the Shanghai show, but you put the wrong answer here. We can't unsee it. You got to do something different. And that was weird. But it was definitely a life experience covering that auto show. So,
I got to make it out there at some point. Yeah, for sure.
Definitely worth covering. Well, that's all the time we have. We don't have to spend my money this week. We've been talking about summer beers. Do you have a go-to drink you're sipping on during these hot July days?
You know, don't laugh at me, but I've been loving this thing called, have you heard of Sun Boy?
No.
It's a spiked coconut water drink.
Let me tell you, I've been loving this thing. It tastes great. You know, coconut water is supposed to be good for you, right?
So, yeah.
Natural flavors, and they kind of spike it with some, I guess, some vodka or whatever they use, whatever alcohol they use. I'm telling you, man, on a hot summer day, nothing better than a Sun Boy. I'm not sponsored by them, by the way. I'm just okay. Letting you know.
I mean, hey, if you get an affiliate link in here somehow, I don't know. I mean, that's here I am just sipping gin and tonics like an old man. I guess I need to try something different.
Well, you know, some boys early in the day get the gin teas in the afternoon, so nothing wrong with that.
That's true. That drink sounds like something you could do some brunching with, or you know, ease into the afternoon. And hey, whatever keeps you cool here in the summer.
Yeah, so, man.
All right. Well, that's all the time we have this week. Thanks for joining us, Pras. It's again, it's podcast@autoblog.com. Send us your spend my monies or mailbags if you want to jump in there during the summer months. We can be very user driven. If you got a question, jump in there. We'd love to answer it. Again, 5 stars on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you get the show. Be safe out there. And we'll see you next week.